Welcome once again to the Idaho Pulse. This is your host, Tea Party Bob, here to bring you information about things that are happening in our state that will not get, mentioned in the liberal media. Today, we have one of our regular guests, Ronald Nate, president of the Idaho Freedom Foundation, an organization that actually does the homework that the liberal media has refused to do. So let me welcome Ron to the Idaho Pulse, and let's hear what words of wisdom he has for us today. Welcome, Ron.
Hello, Bob. Great to be back on Idaho Pulse. I'll just tell you right up front, I'm talking to you remotely today. I am actually in Orlando, Florida. I'm at a conference called the State Policy Network. And what the State Policy Network is an opportunity for state policy think tanks and action tanks like Idaho Freedom Foundation to get together, compare notes, talk with one another, build alliances, so to speak, so that we can work on good freedom, limited government policy across Idaho, and that these other states can do the same thing. So there are 63 affiliates with this. So there's 63 other Idaho Freedom Foundation-like organizations across the United States. Idaho Freedom Foundation is the only one unique to Idaho. There's some others like the Freedom Foundation, which works across a lot of different states, but Idaho Freedom Foundation is the only one that is specifically Idaho. And so we are here to represent. We are also here to learn and grow and figure out what Idaho needs to do to maintain its competitive edge in terms of being a beacon for freedom across the U.S.
Well, I hope you won't mind me today interrupting you on several things, because I have a bone to pick with the Idaho politicians and what's been going on in our state for the past 20 years.
Newsflash, everyone. Bob Neugebauer has a problem with Idaho politicians and Idaho government. What is it? What's the specific problem today, Bob?
It's not one, it's many. It's the fact that you can't trust these people because they never do their homework. They promise you arpege and they give you the stink bomb.
I can't disagree. There's been a lot of times I've been felt let down by politicians who talk one way and then act another. And that's why we exist, frankly. That's why Idaho Freedom Foundation is around, is to be a form of government and politician accountability by showing Idahoans what really is going on in the state house and in local governments versus what is being told to them. So what's the issue that's got you fired up today?
Well, right now, the issue is the New Deal for the INL and all of the big business it's going to bring to Idaho from the federal government so they can reprocess fuel rods and take one third of all of the radioactive material waste from every state that wants to put it here and put it up there at the INL. Mm-hmm. Now, you remember the last time they did this?
Oh, yeah, the problems with managing and running the waste and everything like that, it really hamstrung us for decades.
In 1950 through 1983, they were putting waste into the ground that was liquefied. They just put it in the ground, expecting it to disappear. Well, it did, right into the aquifer. Mm-hmm. The Snake River aquifer, by the way. And they're still trying to clean it up. But they say they resolved all those problems now and that it's safe. Well, let me tell you something. They said Three Mile Island was also safe. They said Chernobyl was also safe. Now we're looking at putting more waste than we have ever before taken in into a repository that still sits over one of our largest aquifers. And by the way, is not exempt from an earthquake.
Well, let me frame some of my comments this way. Nuclear energy, I think, is the answer to our energy problems.
Agreed.
Wind is not going to do it. Solar's not going to do it. Hydro has limited capabilities. But nuclear power is a source of energy which is remarkably strong and vast for a little amount of fuel. The only drawback I see to nuclear energy is dealing with the waste. Now, as a naive economist here, I'm like, you know, I thought it would be an obvious way to deal with waste, and Elon Musk might actually agree with me that why don't you just jettison it into space? I mean, let it go, let it go, instead of trying to bury it in our ground. But anyway, the amount of waste that is generated from nuclear power production is remarkably small. There is not a lot of it. Do I think Idaho ought to be the repository of all that waste? Probably not. I don't want a battle over nuclear waste to get in the way of a source of energy that can be very beneficial to man, essentially.
I don't disagree with you. In general, I don't disagree with you. But the waste problem is a serious problem. The people of sure. Yucca Flats did not want the waste down there. Now, yeah. Do you realize how long it takes for plutonium-239 to become basically harmless?
No.
24,000 years.
Oh, well. Well, the first 100 years, which will span all of our lifetimes, should be no different than the next 100 years. And so, yeah, I don't know. We dealing with the waste is something that I think the energy industry can figure out. I just see a time where nuclear is going to be the predominant energy source just because it is so dramatically efficient.
I don't disagree, but I don't think that Idaho should be the repository for 1/3 of the waste in the country.
No. Send it to the moon. Send it to outer space.
I don't care where they send it, as long as it's not here.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there you go. And, man, as feeble as we are, we haven't shown that we can deal with it that well, because it was a problem in Idaho for decades. And yeah.
No, it's just a question I had to ask. It's just been on my mind for the last week.
Yeah, well, I think it's a very good one. And if we can crack that nut, then we can just realize that nuclear energy is a very beneficial prospect for our energy needs. Yeah.
Well, look, energy, just like what happened today when the Idaho Power said they're going to have to raise our electric bills by so much, maybe 3%, because there's a low amount of water. Have you ever heard of them lowering the rates because we had an abundance of water?
That's a very good question, is that, hey, it's been a very wet year, we're going to lower your power rates. No, never happens. But whenever it's dry, and by the way, whenever it's a drought year, they're like, well, thank goodness we have cloud seeding. But I'm thinking that, you know, cloud seeding should make it so we never have a dry year. I thought that yep. was the point. And so it's an amazing thing to have it both ways. When it's a wet year, they're like, hey, cloud seeding, it was very beneficial. When it's a dry year, hey, good thing we had cloud seeding. And you're like, oh, really? It's like we shouldn't have the dry year if we had cloud seeding working the way it should. And by the way, a lot of Idahoans are frustrated and fearful about cloud seeding because there seems to be a lot of secrecy and not a lot of disclosure about what it really is, how it really works, and what the potential dangers are. And so I know legislators who are working on legislation, or at least memorials, to say, you know what, let's put a pause on this until we have more information.
No, we're just like, maybe we should put a pause on putting any more waste up there in the INL.
Yeah. Until we have more information. But I know this is how politics work, is that we elect senators and congressmen to go to D.C. And the expectation from a lot of Idahoans is bring back these projects to Idaho, bring back the federal dollars to Idaho. Idaho state government is 40% dependent on federal dollars. The job of our representatives is not to go to Washington, D.C., expand the federal government, but it's all good and peachy because we're bringing dollars back to Idaho. How about we just don't send the dollars away to begin with, and that we let Idaho run Idaho and let the federal government do its minimal role and not have Idaho be a subsidiary of the federal government?
I don't disagree with you, okay? I mean, we look at what happened at Lava Ridge. Nobody did anything in the political world except for our attorney general to try and stop that. We have a governor who has accepted data centers without understanding the cost of the electric and the water problem that we may have at some point in time. We expand Micron by another 10,000 square feet and don't realize how much electricity or water they're going to use. I mean, think about the dumb things our politicians in this state have done over the last 10 to 20 years. It is abominable.
Yeah. Well, Milton Friedman used to say the art of politics is getting the wrong people to do the right things because you've lined up the incentives the proper way.
Thank you. That's exactly the way I feel.
And so right now the incentives are working against us, that the politicians are rewarded for working with big business and big government to bring the dollars in. And then they get to go and cut ribbons and make their Facebook posts and say how great Idaho, how well off Idaho is because of their work to bring the money back. Well, we need a paradigm shift.
Ron, I spent 37 years in the brokerage businesses doing all kinds of stock and bond deals. I will tell you, only about 3% of the companies who I actually work with actually cared about what they were doing and how it affected the people, and did it for the purpose of improving things, not making money.
Yep. That's right. So let me do this. Can I talk about a specific Idaho policy for a minute?
Let's go.
We talked about school choice a lot, but here's something I want to point out about school choice. And Idaho is in its first year of its very young school choice program and very limited school choice program. It's limited to about 10,000 students because of the amount of money that government gives up by letting people keep more of their tax dollars instead of sending it in. It's a school choice program that says you pay less in taxes when your kid, when you've opted your kid out of public schools. That's all it is. It's not government dollars going to private schools. It's people keeping more of their money and funding private schools instead of standing in as tax dollars. Well, I went to a great little session here on, you know what, the benefits of school choice isn't just for the students who opt out of public schools. Now, I keep hearing from public schools and public school teachers and public school administrators that they're worried about school choice because it takes money away from public schools. And they're really concerned about public schools. They're not. They're really concerned about public school employees. They're really concerned about their established
jobs. Their jobs.
But they will make the argument that if public schools were fully funded, they would be performing as well or as better as whatever private school options there are. Well, the evidence does not show that in order to see any kind of improvement in public school education, they say we want to increase funding. Well, in Idaho, we spend about $13,000 per student a year. If we increase that by $1,000 per student, $1,000 per student. Now, that would be quite an investment in public education spending. We would see the improvement of students based on these studies of about 0.3% improvement.
About not very high, is it?
No, it's not very high, but it is an improvement. But it's a very expensive improvement. $1,000 more per student to get about a 0.3% increase. And that's, that's less than a standard deviation increase in student performance. And so you go, you know what? I don't dispute their argument that more money for public education will help students. The question is, what will help students more? And let's look at school choice. If we spent the same kind of money on school choice and looked at the students in public education, I'm not saying let's look at the students who exercise school choice. I'm looking at the students within public education, the ones who did not opt for school choice. There is an improvement that happens because of school choice, because of the increase in competition, because of the administration worried about losing students, saying we need to step up our game. And it's about a factor of 12 over what just funding more public education is. So $1,000 per student spent more on school choice translates into about 12 times the increase in student performance that just giving the same amount of money to public education would be.
So the question is, why haven't we done more of it? And why don't the administrators and teachers and the politicians understand the dynamics of doing something like this?
Well, first of all, I think they themselves don't even know the evidence on this. That if you look at the studies, if we wanted to run an expansion of school choice bill next year, teachers and administrators would come and testify against it. And they would say, look, we need to fund more public education. We don't need to fund more school choice. And they would cite a study, the Jackson study back in 2023 or something, and say, look, this shows that spending more on public education helps. Well, it helps 0.3%. But what they don't see is the counterfactual, that if school choice is expanded, the increase is 12 times as big.
Because it's competition.
For public education students. So if you're really worried about all students, this study looks at public education students and sees them being helped 12 times as much through school choice than just throwing more money at the public education problem. And here's the other benefit, that these improvements don't just happen once, they compound. And so whatever benefits you see in years 1, 2, and 3, which are the first years where it's hard to see any benefits to begin with, those are multiplied by factors over the years when you get to 10 and 15 years of this and 20 years of this, the results even get better over time.
But that's nothing more than competition drives innovation.
That's right. We saw that the $1,000 spent more per student in public education would lead to, here's a way to measure it, an average of about 5 to 6 days of gained learning. So 5 to 6 days of learning added to their school experience. School choice program, which is would be funded the same, would add 120 days of additional learning on average.
What's different between this and
that's public school students.
But what's different between that and corporate entities that invest in themselves? Because competition comes in and creates a reason for them to do that.
That's right. God, there's so many more aspects. You talk about corporations, talk about, public-private, public versus private. But we're trying to steel man this as much as we can. What is the gain to public education for investing more in public education? What is the gain to public education students when we have more competition via school choice? And the results couldn't be more stark, that school choice adds more to the public school experience than throwing more money at the public school experience.
How do you get that across to the politicians and the voters?
I, You just have to keep confronting with them with the evidence. So when they cite the Jackson study that it added 0.3%, you just have to say, you know what? Scaling school choice by the same factor leads to 11 to 12 times more effectiveness than simply increasing school spending. And you just got to keep confronting them with the evidence. And it's an amazing thing. And so I think in this next legislative session, we ought to look at making our school choice more universal, in that we don't have an income test for it, that any student that wants it ought to be able to exercise it. And the students who will benefit are not just those who exercise school choice, but all the other students who see public school as still their best option tend to do way better than when there's no school choice.
Let me make a prediction. If indeed you did something like that, I tell you, you will lose between 10 and 20% of the students in public school that will want to go for school choice, because that's where they really want to be, but they can't get there.
Yeah. And in Arizona, they've been running their school choice program for, 5 to 10 years now. 10% of the students in Arizona are in private or homeschool settings. Now, that means that 90% are in public schools, but those 90% are not falling behind. They're actually doing a lot better than if there was no school choice. And so that is the narrative shift that needs to happen, is school choice benefits all students. And if you're worried about public school students, school choice benefits public school students more than any other program yet discovered. Even looking at tutoring, looking at more school days, looking at paying teachers more, looking at just paying the schools more. Nothing compares to school choice as creating the incentives for improved education for all students.
Because it increases innovation, it makes people work harder. It actually gives you an opportunity to change a system that is so archaic in so many ways that it really has been misguided for many years. People don't get that. And you have to teach them by showing them. Competition is a great way to do it.
It is. And, you know, I'll just finish with this little economic experience with it, is that I cannot imagine the innovations that could happen if but given the choice to do that. That, you know, in private industry, there has been tremendous periods of growth in the U.S., tremendous innovations that none of us could have imagined before the fact. But then afterwards, we look back at it and go, I cannot believe electric cars are driving themselves now. Now, if we tasked government 100 years ago with the job of create electric cars that can drive themselves, do you think we'd have that now?
No.
But the industry did it on its own because there was a huge incentive for innovation and expansion of technology. And so things we couldn't dream of happen in a free market. And we just look at it and go, well, yeah, of course that happened. But if government was doing things, would we ever get there? No. They might offer a wider variety of colors of automobiles, but not necessarily better ones.
Well, is it any different than the fact that everybody wants to import electric automobiles, but nobody realizes how much electricity it takes to charge all of these cars, or the fact that we don't have any charging stations worthwhile around the country? So what are we doing? We have gas cars.
Well, yeah, gas cars. And you know what? It's a paradigm shift in the automobile industry, too, that you know, if you had an electric car, you can drive to Salt Lake and you're not going to run out of charge there. There's enough charging. You know, the grid fixes itself. That just more people use it than more of it's developed.
I have a friend of mine lives in Salt Lake City, comes up here to visit her mother. She has to stop in Boise to charge her car.
There you go. Yeah, that's okay. It's okay. You know what? We didn't have to artificially build a network of gasoline stations for the automobile. It just happened as a natural evolution in the market that the market finds a way.
Agreed.
Hey, I got two more topics. You have time for two more topics?
Oh, I always have time for you, Ron. I'm glad you're back. Okay.
All right. Stop Prop 1. The battle continues, and this is going to be huge. That we are building a network of folks who want to work against this proposition because we're talking about innocent babies' lives on the line. And here is the blessing that comes from this Prop 1 battle is that I have seen conservatives come together like no other time in the past, that we are united on this idea of protecting innocent lives. And so the grassroots network is growing, the network of conservative groups working together. We're going to crush this proposition. Now, I don't say that for you to for everyone to relax and go, oh, okay, it's going to go down. No, everyone has to do the work. And if we can crush this, like ranked choice voting was crushed, if we can show that 70% of Idahoans want nothing to do with unfettered access to abortion, then maybe we can crush it forever. And the benefit that goes on forward, obviously, many thousands of saved lives in Idaho, 1,500 a year. The other benefit is that we have a conservative movement that can do a lot of other good things that was created out of this opposition to Prop 1. And so let's take that weaponry that was developed for this very important battle and use it for all the other important battles, like reducing taxes, like getting the government out of every aspect of our lives, including healthcare and vaccine mandates and everything else the government imposes on us. We will have an army here to do a lot of good things.
Ron, I fight for that every day on the radio. And I have to tell you, it doesn't seem to be making a dent in the conservatives who are so for getting rid of this Prop 1, but they don't seem to care about so many other important issues. How do you get them to change? How do you get them interested?
Well, let's show what can happen when we do work together. So let's crush this Prop 1, and then we'll look at each other and go, wow, that was amazing. We crushed Prop 1. All right, now let's crush the idea of property taxes. Let's put our minds together and work on that. And we can even handle the first most obvious lame question that we get. What are we going to replace the money with? We're going to replace it with reduced government. That's what we're going to replace it with. Government is swimming around in way more money than it needs. There's plenty to go around. We don't need a property tax on top of everything else. So we'll have that. It'll be amazing. It'll be amazing.
You mean we didn't really need that $7 billion more in budget over the last 7 to 8 years? Yeah, we could actually get rid of it.
It's been growing way, way too fast. And so a few years of fiscal discipline and we can see, we can start to gain back some of that opportunity that was lost. Government taking over more of the economy results in inefficiency, results in a misallocation of resources. And only when you start to dial it back do you realize, wow, the market could have done a lot better here. But when you're in it, you don't realize the opportunity cost the government imposes on society.
You only have to look at the infrastructure in the Treasure Valley to figure that out.
Yep, that's true. Last thing I want to talk about is I have a very short Econ 101 lesson today. And it's from macroeconomics, principles of macroeconomics, and it's measuring the health of the economy, measuring how big the economy is. And when we talk about economic growth and what the economy is all about, really it is the command over resources, converting them into goods and services, and what we can produce with all of our resources. So when we talk about gross domestic product, okay, I don't want all your listeners' eyes to glaze over, but gross domestic product is a very boring name for how much is being produced in the economy. How many goods and services are being produced? That's the measure of production in an economy. And there's a couple ways to measure it, and it's always measured in dollar terms, you know, dollars of of goods and services produced. So naturally, prices start to factor into the mix when you talk about it. But here's how do we measure that? Well, you could measure it by adding up all the goods and services produced and how much that is worth. And that's really the way we kind of do it. And it's called, you know, we call it gross domestic product, and it's the sum of four categories. All the spending on consumption of goods and services. So when households buy goods and services, we add up all that spending. Well, that's what households have consumed of the goods and services produced. So that's one big component. And it is the biggest component, close to 70%. The second category is businesses buying goods and services. And I don't mean ingredients or intermediate goods, because those are imbued in the final goods. So I mean when businesses buy a new factory, when businesses buy a new truck or whatever, then that is businesses consuming goods and services. Net exports, so it's other countries buying goods and services, minus the fact that we buy some goods and services from other countries, so we wouldn't want to count that as ours. And so it's really net exports. Whenever we produce something and sell it to a foreign country, that should count as our production as well. And here's the last category, and the one that I want to raise a warning flag about, and that is government spending. Government buys goods and services too. Sometimes government produces it themselves, and we add that in, like when they build a nuclear submarine or a stealth bomber or something like that, or a government building. But government does buy paper, they buy office chairs, bureaucratic things, they buy vehicles. And so government spending is part of it. And so really when I teach economic product, it's consumption, investment, government spending, and net exports, CIG, net exports. And we add those up to get the total production in the economy. And that is macro 101. I'm looking at the Federal Reserve website right now and looking what gross domestic product is, and they've put it into four categories: personal consumption, business investment, net exports of goods and services, and government spending on goods and services. It is exactly those four categories. But here's the catch. Did you know that because government spending is part of that calculation, that whenever there's a recession or something like that and government increases its spending, it automatically makes the economy look better than it is, because government spending is counted as part of the economic production. So it's really a misnomer to say that FDR rescued us from the Great Depression because they dramatically increased government spending back then. They just redirected the spending away from the private sector toward the government sector. And if you look at the data, the Great Depression was only great because FDR extended it by 8 to 10 years. Not that he solved it.
Never should have had a third term.
Or a second one. Or a first one. You know, when they do surveys on the best presidents, for some reason, FDR pops up into the top five best presidents. I put him in the bottom two. Because a lot of what he did was simply surface that, you know, made you think that the economy was better when it really wasn't. In fact, go 10 years earlier. When Woodrow Wilson left office, it was Harding and then Coolidge. Coolidge inherited an economy that was almost an exact replica of the economy inherited by FDR. Unemployment was going up, approaching 10%, both in the early 20s and the early 30s. Prices were going down, which sounds like a good thing for a consumer, but it's a very bad thing for an economy. Because if prices are going down, businesses do not generate enough revenue to buy the resources for the next cycle of production. It's a very bad thing. It's a sign of a bad economy. Investment was going down dramatically. The production of goods and services was going down dramatically. Beginning of Coolidge's term looked a lot like the beginning of FDR's. Coolidge did not do increase in government spending, did not do a New Deal, did not create Social Security, did not do all those things that FDR did, which were surface things that looked like the economy was better because it was just government spending. All Coolidge did was reduce the income tax rates down from 70% that Wilson had them back down to about 14 or 15%. What did we have? The Roaring Twenties. What did FDR have? The Great Depression for over a decade.
And by the way, tax rates stayed up at that 70 after FDR got in up until the 70s.
That's right. And in the 60s, the top tax rate was in the 90%.
Yeah, you're correct. Yes.
Who wants to work for another dollar when 90 cents of it goes to the government and you keep 10 cents of it?
I'm going to Mexico.
That's right. And then you, when you go to spend that 10 cents, you get to pay sales taxes, you get to pay state income taxes on it. There's all sorts of things. And so really you're working for nothing. And so that's my lesson today, is macroeconomics is very deceiving because government spending is counted as part of the health of the economy. And also that when government does it, it displaces the private sector. And so even though you may think the numbers are getting better, the people don't feel it.
You know, I only wish you could teach this course to all of the politicians we have in office currently.
Yeah. You know, I taught in college for 25 years and it was great to visit with those students on a daily basis, hear about what they're thinking, teach them what economics is about, and feel like they can go out and make a difference. But when I tell the same stories, give the same lessons to legislators, the problem is, you know, Reagan used to say, Democrats aren't so much of a problem. It's just that so much of what they think is true is not true. So much of what they think they know happens to be false. And that's what I find with legislators, is that they're beyond the point of listening because they think they've got it all figured out, when history has shown that even an FDR hasn't got it figured out.
Well, Democrats have a lot of false positives.
True. And so that's why Idaho Freedom Foundation exists. That's why the Idaho Pulse exists, because we're out there trying to spread the truth beyond what people believe on the surface. There are so many false notions out there about how the economy works. We need more people like you and me out there, Bob.
Well, I hope I can stay around a little longer so we can do that someday.
Oh, yeah, you're going to stay around a little longer. So let's get this done. Yeah.
Well, thank you again for being here. I do appreciate having you on.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Bob. Thank you and your team. Idaho Pulse is awesome. I look forward to next week. Talk some more.
Take care, my friend. Be careful down there in Florida. I hear the gators are very ravenous when it comes to people from Idaho.
Okay, well, yeah, I haven't seen any yet, but I think I might get a taste of some tonight, so we'll see.
I try the golf courses. I've lost many balls out on those.
That's great. Have a great day. Peace out, my
friend. Take care. Take care, my friend. Thank you very much.
You bet.